The name of my talk is The Finger Snap Sutra. I'll bet that you didn't know that there was a teaching given by the Buddha called the Finger Snap Sutta. It's true. It's a short, snappy sutra. But rather than read the entire sutra, I'm going to approach it in sections. And this is definitely not a well-known Buddha sutra. And just in case people don't know, a Buddha sutra is a teaching given by the Buddha. The Buddha's sutras are especially important to the Theravadan Buddhists. And these are the Buddhists that practice in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, and Laos. And those people, those practitioners study only what the Buddha taught and studied. So this is really different from our Zen tradition, because we have all those teachings of our Chinese and Japanese ancestors and our rich tradition of koans. The Finger Snap Sutta, and sutta is the Pali word, and sutra is the Sanskrit word, and I'll use both of these terms. This was one of a list of sutras that some of us were asked to study. So imagine that you are monks and that the Buddha is addressing you. This mind, monks, is luminous, but is defiled by taints that come from without. But this, the uneducated, many folk, understands not as it really is. Wherefore, for the uneducated, many folk, there is no cultivation of the mind, I declare. This mind, monks, is luminous, but is cleansed of taints that come from without. This, the educated disciple, understands as it really is. Wherefore, for the educated disciple, there is cultivation of the mind, I declare. The mind is luminous. What a great line. The mind is luminous. Our minds are pure just as they are, but we don't generally experience our minds this way. We have covered over this luminosity with thoughts, feelings, and emotions, and then identified with these. We've forgotten who we really are. In the sutra, the Buddha talks about taints, which basically means defilements, which come from greed, hate, and delusion. And he seems to be making a distinction here between Buddhist practitioners and non-practitioners. Buddhist practitioners, or monks, understand that defilements are not intrinsic to the nature of the mind. With this understanding, one can practice to cut away or prune these defilements or taints back. If, on the other hand, you are an uneducated person, meaning that you don't practice, you don't understand that the mind is actually clear and bright. You can only perceive defilements. You don't know that there is any other reality. I find it interesting how the classical or Theravadan approach is to focus on the defilements and the need to subdue them or cleanse the mind of them. In our Zen tradition, we would tend to emphasize the basic intrinsic brightness of the mind and don't get as focused on the thoughts, feelings, etc. that pass through the mind. That's not to say we ignore these thoughts and emotions. We are mindful of them so we don't get carried away by them. Buddha nature is the central concept in Zen Buddhism and is similar to what the Buddha is saying here. One definition of Buddha nature is the luminous mind of all sentient beings that eventually, cleared of all defilements, will become Buddha. The sun may be hidden by clouds, but it is always there. Our Buddha nature likewise may be obscured by our attachments and defilements, but it is always there. It's not something we have, like a soul, but something that we are. I got that from the Dharma Weekly website. I was reminded of when I was at a three-month practice period at Tassajara, which is a training monastery for the San Francisco Zen Center. The abbot there gave a talk about this koan. Dame once asked Master Madzu, "What is Buddha?" Madzu replied, "This very mind is Buddha." Now Dame, who was a student of Madzu, wasn't asking about the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni. He was asking about fundamental truth. So this very mind is Buddha. Both the Buddha, I think, and Mazu are talking about Buddha nature, the essence of what we all are. The abbot went on to express that this very mind includes the mind that is scattered, angry, fearful, anxious, in other words, has taints. This may sound different than what the Buddha said, but not really, because our luminous mind is always there, just like our Buddha nature is always there. It's like the sky, which is clear and blue, but sometimes we don't see the clear blue sky because it is covered by clouds, but it is still there. So the clear sky is like our mind, and the clouds are the thoughts and emotions that pass through. Knowing that we are Buddha nature and have a luminous mind is not a justification to stop practicing or sitting zazen. In fact, I like to think of it as inspiration to keep practicing, to uncover the Buddha nature that we all have, we all are. And I would repeat this line, this very mind is Buddha, like a mantra on and off the cushion to remind myself of my potential for awakening, to keep me inspired. An updated version of this section of the sutra goes, the mind is luminous but is polluted by the toxins that are dumped into it. And a good analogy of this is a body of water and the five hindrances. The five hindrances are five mental factors which hinder progress in our practice as well as our life. The five hindrances are sense desire or lust, ill will or any form of anger, sloth and torpor, which is sleepiness of the mind, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And this is the kind of doubt that causes us to lose confidence in ourselves and even the Dharma. So if you have a bowl of water and put dyes in it, the water is no longer clear. This is likened to the hindrance of sense desire. In the case of ill will, the body of water is said to be like water that is heated to boiling, hence the term, I am boiling mad. For the hindrance of sloth and torpor, sleepiness or sluggishness of the mind, it is likened to water covered with weeds and algae, obscuring the surface. Restlessness and worry is compared to water that is whipped into waves by wind, churning and swirling. And the hindrance of doubt is likened to unsettled, turbid, murky water. But remember that under all of these hindrances or taints or defilements, the mind is luminous, clear and calm, just like the water before any toxins are dumped into it. On to the next part of the sutra. Monks, if for just the lasting of a finger snap, a monk indulges a thought of goodwill, such a one is to be called a monk. Not empty of result is his musing. He abides doing his master's bidding. He is one who takes advice and eats the country's alms food to some purpose. What then should I say of those who make much of such a thought? Monks, if for just the lasting of a finger snap, a monk cultivates a thought of goodwill, such a one is to be called a monk. Not empty of result is his musing. He dwells during doing the master's bidding. He is one who takes advice, and he eats the country's alms food to some purpose. Monks, if for just the lasting of a finger snap, a monk gives attention to a thought of goodwill, such a one is to be called a monk. Not empty is his musing. He dwells doing the master's bidding. He is one who takes advice, and he eats the alms food to some purpose. What then should I say of those who make much of such a thought? And that is very typical of a Buddhist sutra where there's a lot of repetition. When I was typing the word fingersnap at the beginning, I typed it all as all one word, and the computer kept replacing it with ginger snap. So this happened several times until I put the hyphen in it. So for a little while, the sentence read, monks, if for just the lasting of a ginger snap, and I thought, what a great way to practice eating ginger snaps and cultivating thoughts of goodwill. So after explaining that the luminous mind is defiled by taints, the Buddha has given his monks and us a way to work with the mind. So what is the importance of indulging in, cultivating, and giving attention to thoughts of goodwill? The second noble truth of the Eightfold Path is sometimes translated as right thought. This is from the Dhammapada. And the Dhammapada is a collection of sayings by the Buddha. All we are is a result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man acts or speaks with a pure thought, happiness follows him like a shadow that never leaves him. That sounds like a good thing to keep in mind. Goodwill is called metta in Pali, which is often translated as loving kindness. And there is a whole kind of meditation based on cultivating loving kindness as well as compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And this particular practice is known as the four Brahma Viharas, which translates out as four heavenly realms. And you start by sending loving kindness to yourself, and then someone that you know, a friend, someone that you like or love. Then to someone neutral, and then to your enemies. And then you repeat that process with compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. And it seems like the Buddha here is giving us a mini metta practice. He underlines the power of this moment of a thought of goodwill by saying it makes us worthy monks, deserving of alms food. And this is a quote from Bhikkhu Paiuto, who was a well-known Thai Buddhist monk. When there is goodwill, the mind is naturally happy, cheerful, and clear. Thoughts of goodwill are also an antidote to selfishness, anger, and fear, which commonly arise in the mind as taints. And when we have a thought of goodwill for ourselves or another, there is no room in that moment for a thought of ill will, or jealousy, or even delusion. When I spent time in a Burmese monastery some years ago, the abbot who was called Sayadaw Upandita was a very stern, fierce figure. I was quite terrified of him at times. And one evening during a Dharma talk, he told us through the translator that he really liked Pollyanna. Now, many or most of you here are probably too old to remember Pollyanna, which was a movie made in 1960 with Hayley Mills. Does anyone remember Hayley Mills? It was based on the book Pollyanna, a book written in 1913 about a young orphan who believes that life's most difficult problems can be overcome by a positive attitude. And she had a philosophy of life that was centered on the glad game. And that consisted of finding something to be glad about in any situation, no matter how bad or horrible it may be. So when her cold, stern aunt puts her in a stuffy attic with no furniture or pictures, Pollyanna becomes thrilled with a beautiful view from the high window. She goes on to make friends with all the townsfolk and engage them in her glad game, even the crusty, crabby ones. Pollyanna is really tested when she's hit by a car and she loses the use of her legs. And when she becomes aware of the seriousness of her situation, she's devastated and her cheerfulness and her spirits plummet. But because of all her goodwill and cheer that she has spread in the community, her neighbors and townsfolk rally around her and tell her how much she has changed their lives. Change and improve their lives, Pollyanna is able to revive her spirits and can be glad that she at least had the use of her legs. There is a happy ending and she does recover the use of her legs. Pollyanna has become a noun. If someone is excessively cheerful or optimistic, they are called a Pollyanna. And in our somewhat cynical culture, it is often used as an insult or criticism, as this kind of person can seem blindly optimistic and sometimes even a little out of touch with reality. And I can think of a couple of people in my life who I would sometimes describe as Pollyannas. But when I think of stern, unsmiling Upandita and his enthrallment with this unfailingly cheerful orphan, it makes me smile. And maybe he was on to something. A positive attitude is helpful in our life and in our Dharma practice. So Buddha is using the finger snap to underscore that you just need to have a momentary thought of goodwill to make you a worthy monk. It's also an acknowledgement that there is liberation in every moment. But he is also saying, I believe, that you want to cultivate and grow those wholesome thoughts so that they become more habitual, even more your default, kind of like our friend Pollyanna. Does everyone know what a mindfulness bell is? Okay, a mindfulness bell is rung, often in practice settings or in retreats, to remind everyone to come back to the present moment, to the body, to drop whatever is happening in the mind. So it is rung periodically through the day. At Tassajara, we didn't have a mindfulness bell that was rung, but sometimes in the middle of a sitting meditation, seemingly out of nowhere, the abbot or the head monk would say, "Where are you now?" Or, "What's happening now?" And that was a reminder to us to come back to the body, to the breath, and the present moment. And I can't help but think of using a finger snap in this way. The past 2 weeks, when I was putting this talk together, I've been using the finger snap in this way for myself, to stop, come back to the present moment, and then to bring up a thought of goodwill, love, or peace. The mindfulness finger snap. But could a finger snap be something more profound? Here is a new koan. Question: what is Buddha? Answer: the next line of the sutta goes like this. Monks, whatsoever things are evil, have part in evil, or on the side of evil, all such things, all such have mind for their causing. First arises mind as the forerunner of them, and those evil things follow after. First, a disclosure. I have an aversion to the word evil. I personally don't think that the early Buddhists believed in evil, at least not in the way we use it in our culture. Translation is a factor here as well. In the Pali language, there are two terms, kusala and akusala, meaning respectively wholesome and unwholesome states or behavior. It often relates to states or behaviors. Akusala, or unwholesome, doesn't quite have the punch of the word evil, and it doesn't correspond perfectly, but it may be a better choice of words in this situation. On the other hand, saying that someone like Hitler was unwholesome just doesn't cut it. So as I was going down this rabbit hole of evil in Buddhism, I found an article, and this is an excerpt from it. This is from Barbara O'Brien. She is a Zen Buddhist and journalist who covers religion in American politics and culture, and she has quite a number of essays online. She starts off by saying that evil is a word that many people use without thinking deeply about what it signifies. She goes on to say, it's common to think of evil as an intrinsic characteristic of some people or groups. In other words, some people are said to be evil. Evil is a quality that is inherent in their being. And that's what I think of when I hear the word evil. Someone who is bad through and through to their core. And this just doesn't jibe with Buddhist Dharma. It certainly doesn't jibe with the concept of Buddha nature, which we all are at the most profound level. How can I be evil if I am Buddha nature? O'Brien again. The acts of sorting humanity into good and evil carries a terrible trap. When other people are thought to be evil, it becomes possible to justify doing them harm. Human history is thoroughly saturated by violence and atrocity committed on behalf of good against people categorized as evil. Most of the mass horrors humanity has inflicted upon itself may have come from this kind of thinking. People intoxicated by their own self-righteousness or who believe in their own intrinsic moral superiority too easily give themselves permission to do terrible things to those they hate or fear. Okay, now that I have that off my chest, the main point of the line of the sutta is that everything that we say or do originates in our minds. The mind comes first. In order to stop speaking and acting in harmful or unskillful ways, it helps to pay attention to our mind. And even if we stop ourselves from speaking and acting in ways that bring about negative results, having afflictive emotion still causes us to suffer. Here's another quote from the Buddha from the Dhammapada. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. If with an impure mind a person speaks or acts, suffering follows him like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. If with a pure mind a person speaks or acts, happiness follows him like his never departing shadow. Then he says, he abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. Those who harbor such thoughts do not still their hatred. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me. Those who do not harbor such thoughts still their hatred. Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. This is an eternal law. In Buddhism, we have the five precepts to live by for good or skillful conduct, and this is important so we don't harm ourselves or harm others. The precepts are often learned by people early on when they come to Buddhist practice, and it's about morality, without which we would have a difficult time doing zazen. As someone once said, it's hard to kill someone in the morning and have and be able to meditate with calmness and concentration in the afternoon. Now that's an extreme example. But everything we say and do has its origins in the mind. The three poisons of greed, hate, and delusions are mental factors. They arise in the mind, and if we're not aware or mindful, they can cause us to act in unskillful ways. And I often think of practice as a process of working backwards. You know, first do we become aware of how our actions or our speech affect other people, especially in a negative way. We're seeing the results of what comes out of our mouths as well when we speak, and the pain and hurt it causes. And as we do this, we naturally become more aware of our thoughts, emotions, which leads to these actions and speech. And as we become more aware of what's happening in our mind, what's arising in our mind, we can start disengaging from the thoughts and emotions that are there. We don't have to run after them. When I was practicing Vipassana, we were instructed to label everything, the rising and falling of the abdomen, every thought, every emotion, every physical sensation. So if you could hear someone, well, we didn't say it out loud, but if you could read my mind, it would sound like rising, falling, thinking, rising, falling, aching, pressure, rising, falling, etc. This labeling is a tool to help be more aware of what is happening in the mind and body on a moment-by-moment basis. And what's interesting is when you are really aware of an object, whether it's a thought or emotion or pain, even painful sensation, it often disappears or it lessens. So the labeling was a mindfulness tool. And we are actually doing the same thing when we sit zazen, being present in the body, focusing on the breath, and being aware of whatever is going on in the mind and the body, be it a thought, an emotion, a physical sensation, general mood, general state. Another quote that underlines the importance of mind, and this is attributed to Lao Tzu, is watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become your habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. Here are the last three lines of the sutta, and I've modified them slightly. Monks, I know not of any other single thing of such power to cause the arising of evil or unwholesome states, if not yet arisen, or to cause the waning of good states, if already arisen, as negligence. In him who is negligent, evil or unwholesome states, if not arisen, do arise, and good states, if arisen, do wane. Monks, I know not of any other single thing of such power to cause the arising of good states, if not yet arisen, or to cause the waning of evil or unwholesome states, if already arisen, as earnestness. In him who is earnest, good states, if not yet arisen, do arise, and evil or unwholesome states, if arisen, do wane. One more time. Monks, I know not of any other single thing of such power to cause the arising of evil or unwholesome states, if not yet arisen, or to cause the waning of good states, if arisen, as indolence. In him who is indolent, evil or unwholesome states, not yet arisen, do arise, and good states, if arisen, do wane. When I listen to these words, I picture the Buddha teaching young monks, encouraging them to be careful with their practice, not to be lazy or careless. He is also telling them, and by extension, us, to be earnest. Earnestness sounds like such an old-fashioned word. It's defined as sincere and intense conviction. To be earnest is to be sincerely zealous. And even though we are not full-time monks who are meditating intensely, doing alms rounds, and following the Vinaya, which is the rules of conduct for monastics, we can still take these words of the Buddha and put them to use. We can be earnest, careful, and diligent in our practice. This human life is precious. And here's a story for you. You may have heard, which comes from the Buddha. If the whole continent became a huge ocean, and within that ocean you had a yoke floating on the waves, and a blind tortoise that popped up once every 500 years, the chances of obtaining precious human birth would be equal to the chances of that blind tortoise emerging with his head poking through the yoke. In Zen, we say, practice like your hair is on fire. Because in a sense, it is. Don't waste time. Last Sunday, Dave did a way-seeking mind talk, which was wonderful. And he quoted Thomas Merton, who is an American Trappist monk. Merton was a writer, theologian, mystic, poet, social activist, and scholar of comparative religion. And I'm going to also to quote Thomas Merton, because to me, this quote speaks to Buddha nature and to love. And this is from The Wise Heart, Jack Kornfield. I'm currently studying it in a book club in Seychelles. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. The depths of their hearts where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach. The core of their reality, the person that each one is in the eyes of the divine. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war. No more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. Thank you.